Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out the new and improved website at scotthorton.org. Thanks, Dave. It's still a work in progress, but man, it's getting better. scotthorton.org. And check out the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out. In fact, I'm looking at the wrong tab, ain't I? Hey, chat room guys. I'm looking at you now. scotthorton.org/chat. And also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right, good deal. So, our guest today is our good friend Sheldon Richman. He is the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org and editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How the hell are you?
I'm doing fine, and thanks for having me back, Scott. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Good to talk to you again. It's been too long. And by the way, also, you keep a blog at SheldonRichman.com. Free Association, it's called. Free as a tethered ass. That's right. So everybody, please check that out. And so this one is TGIF from the 16th. The goal is freedom. The phony trade-off between privacy and security. Well, you know, come on. Seriously, Sheldon? In order for people to live their life and be free, they've got to have a local government monopoly security force in order to protect their rights, right?
Wrong. No, they don't. In fact, it's the government that gets them into trouble and then comes along parading as the protector. But the things it protects us from, you know, wouldn't, for the most part, wouldn't exist if the government weren't, being what it has to be because of its nature.
Oh, yeah? Well, give us some examples then.
Well, I guess, you know, the most relevant examples to the piece refer to foreign policy. And, you know, Ron Paul's old line about they're over here because we're over there. And as you well know, because I've heard you say it many times, history didn't begin on 9/11. There was the U.S. Was not just minding its own business on 9/11 when those guys flew their planes over here, which is not to say they should have flown planes into the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. But the point is there was a history to that, and there's a context. And if we refuse to understand it, we do nothing to make ourselves safer from such things.
So now, let's say we're real cynical and realistic, and we face the fact that we live in this crappy world and that George Bush and Barack Obama have quadrupled down on Bill Clinton's sins that provoked this terror war against us in the first place. Well, and George H.W. Bush's and whatever before that, too. But since, you know, we really do, we being the people who live between Bangor and San Diego here somewhere, between Miami and Portland, we have a threat. There are people who want revenge and have a strategy of actually making our government madder and dumber. And so they very well could try to do some harm to us. And so, come on, shouldn't the NSA be tapping somebody's phone to prevent that? Come on here. We're talking about getting blown up to death.
Well, you can't separate that from the drone campaign and the other forms of aggression in the Muslim world, which is making people mad at us. I mean, the article you referred to was the Obama and other, you know, members of Congress making statements about how, especially in light of the Snowden revelations, we need to strike a balance. We need to have a debate about the proper balance between security and privacy and freedom in general. And I wanted to point out that that's a, number one, it's a phony debate. I mean, they wouldn't even be going through the motions had it not been for Snowden, who they have demonized. On the other hand, they say, we welcome the debate. Well, he made the debate, I put quotes around the word because it's not real, but he made the debate even happen, and yet he's being demonized. So is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? We wouldn't be having even the shell of the debate without him. But this idea that we engage in a trade-off with the government is nonsense. first of all, it's not any kind of contractual trade-off. I mean, you, as I point out in the piece, if you hire a security company, it may need to ask you for certain information you don't normally give out. But you would have a contract which said that they wouldn't disclose the information. And if we really lived in a competitive world, a truly freed market, competition would put pressure on companies to only ask what they, you know, really required and not ask for information beyond that. And you'd shop around and you'd find the best combination of features that suited you. And every other person would do that. So, if you want to call that a trade-off, you could, but the point is it's, you would knowingly be doing it. It would be contractual, and you'd have recourse if the company violated it, like if it disclosed your information. That's not what Obama and Mike Rogers and Peter King mean when they talk about a trade-off. They mean they will set the so-called balance, but my point was when they set it, it's really not even a balance because to the extent they're invading our privacy, they're undermining our security. And I, as I say in the piece, if you've read 1984 or any of the other dystopian novels or seen the movies, you know that when government can spy on us and get information on the people that live under it, those people are less secure because of that. It inhibits their activities. They're concerned that somebody's always looking over their shoulder. So that's a sacrifice of security along with the sacrifice of privacy. In other words, it's not a trade-off. It's not a balance. Both of them go together because privacy / freedom and security are a bundle. They're bundled up. And so you can't give up something to get more of the other thing because they both go together. That's mm-hmm. my point.
Well, and even if you're talking about lethal consequences, the government that can spy on you with impunity can kill you with impunity too. So it's not I'll take a little spying if you'll keep me from getting killed. That doesn't even hold up, you know?
Well, you know, and we shouldn't be looking, you know, to the government for, to keep us safe from being killed. I mean, how many Americans have, you know, never come home because government sent them off to some crusade in a foreign land and they got killed and never made it home? Or how many people who came back just the shell of their former selves because their inner life was shattered, if not their biological life, then, their psychological life. So government, the U.S. government, which supposedly is our protector, kills Americans all the time. I mean, they're still dying in Afghanistan. We know that. And so it's just bogus all around. I just tried to, rip the shroud off. Other people have done this, of course. I don't claim to be the first by any stretch of the imagination, but I just wanted to further rip aside that shroud and let people see what it is we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I remember back before I was, I guess I was kind of born always a hardcore libertarian, but, especially going to government school and all that, one can get really committed to the whole mythology of there's some things that you just don't question about the basis of the society, like having the Constitution, for example. Maybe it's more trouble than it's worth kind of a thing rather than our last ditch protection. Maybe it's the cause of all our problems. That kind of thing is it. You get to people's emotions at that point where, that's one of the things that we don't talk about, like publicly questioning your faith on Sunday morning in front of everybody at church or whatever, people don't like that kind of thing. Sometimes you got to hold their hand a little bit and go, you know what? It's all right to question whether George Washington was actually a decent person at all or whether his legacy has really been a net benefit,
Well, I think there's, for the government to remain in power, it needs to convince people, basically, that it ought to remain in power. A long time ago, there was a thinker by the name of Etienne Labouetti who pointed out that in any society, the number of rulers is dwarfed by the number of people ruled. So for the rulers to stay in power, there's got to be a certain popular, if not consent, that's probably too strong a word, acquiescence, because they could overwhelm the rulers, not even by violence, just by non-cooperation. I mean, imagine if people just decided they didn't recognize these people as legitimate rulers anymore, and they just stopped cooperating with them, paying taxes, etc. The state's forces could kill some people, beat some people, imprison some people. But if the numbers of non-compliant people were large enough, you know, the government would be out of luck. So they have to maintain the acquiescence and minimize the questioning, which is what I think the government schools do and what the whole constitutional edifice does. I mean, it begins with we the people, and this idea is to convince us that this is really us, right? The government is us. Like, you know, Toys R Us, well, the government is us. And as long as we keep believing that, then we're going to be less reluctant to object because, you know, how do you object against yourself? How do you object against your so-called representatives if you really believe they're your representatives? But if you start to strip the stuff away and see that they can't be your representatives, that's a joke. They're part of the ruling elite, and we're on the other side of the divide. They're not of us. And so we need to wear away that ideological facade so that people can see through, you know, to the true nature of things.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to talk about your piece from today, too, Delete the Fed, because I think this is really...
Oh, good.
Good. Because this is, to me, it's at the root of so many problems. That's just a fact, never mind to me. But to me, this is like the greatest scam ever. It's like if anybody ever fed a line of crap to anybody else that they believe, right, other than, you know, in general, the state is here to protect you or whatever. But as far as a specific set of crap, this whole thing about you gotta have the government and these goons work together to control your money supply for your own good has gotta be some kind of world record here anyway. And also, when people learn the truth about it, that, wait a minute, the very money that we use in our every transaction is corrupt. It's like the biggest light bulb going off over their head about, hey, this isn't a republic at all. What is this at all? I don't know what's going on here. Right. And was it right for me to go serve them in a war?
Well, you just have to understand that since 1914, when the Fed opened the doors up, you know, opened its doors, the value of the dollar until this day has fallen, you know, 95%. I mean, I don't think people generally know that. But, okay, so it's worth a nickel today, what you could buy. You know, with a nickel back then, takes a dollar today, and people don't generally know that. But what they really we need to go deeper and explain, because people don't understand this, is that money is not some creation of government. It's not some benevolent creation. Money is a spontaneous, natural, emergent institution that came out of just people trading and trying to facilitate exchange and overcome the inconvenience of barter. And you know, a couple of things became more readily tradable than other things because of particular features. I mean, if it was in the case of precious metals, it's obvious they were relatively scarce. They could be melted down. They could be made coins. You could make coins out of them. You know, it had good features to serve the purpose of being a readily tradable thing. So that even if you didn't want those gold discs for your apples, you knew that you could take the gold discs because when you went to buy something, the sellers would be happy to take the gold discs because they knew that someone else was going to take the gold discs, and so on. So money is not a creature of government, and therefore government is not needed to be a steward of the monetary system. And we know what happens when the monetary system is turned over to the government. It wrecks the money. Plus, it enables the government to engage in profligate, reckless spending and borrowing, which then is used to finance war as well as other things, but war, you know, most particularly in the context of your program, we can then put the emphasis on war.
Yeah, but I heard from a teacher in school somewhere or on TV or something like that, that the Federal Reserve is the restraint, because without them, the banks would create even more money out of nothing all the time. They would make even more bad loans because they're such lousy businessmen, and they would cause the terrible booms and busts all the time.
I cited in my article, which you can find at FFS.org, today's op-ed, which is called Delete the Fed, a link to a great paper published by, you know, three very good monetary economists, people I have great respect for, Larry White, George Selgin, and I think it's William Lestraps, who go through the Fed's history. It's sort of a report card on the Fed as it heads into its second century. They show that by no measure are things better in the Fed era than they were in the pre-Fed era. And don't forget, and they point this out, the pre-Fed era was not a free banking, free market era. So that was a flawed system as well. There were national banks. There was interference at the state and federal levels. But even using that as the comparison, the Fed does not look good. Recessions are longer, have been longer. Recoveries have taken longer. I already mentioned inflation, the devaluation of the dollar. You know, we're down to a nickel. And they use other criteria, too, to show that the Fed's record is terrible. And that's even if you take out the 20. You know, it was pretty new in the 20s. Of course, we get the crash in 29 and then the depression in the 30s. But a lot of economists call the 20s the practice decade because the Fed was just, getting its legs. But even if you take out the 20, the Fed's record looks very bad compared to the pre-Fed period. Now, people don't generally know that. That's taken as an article of faith because it's reinforced from the media and the schools that without the Fed, there'd be chaos. And that's just nonsense.
Well, and so here's the thing, too, is it's sort of like the bias built into the term intelligence, right? If government claims to know something, they automatically categorize it as being smart, even though that ain't necessarily true, kind of thing. And with this, they just, from the very get-go, they've got the jargon all rigged against the truth. It's the business cycle is the boom and the bust, because that's how businesses are, is they just, I don't know, I guess they never think further than a couple of years out or something, and so they way over invest in certain things when they have too much, when they're making too much money. Then they make a bunch of bad investments and a bunch of extra stupid stuff, and then those bubbles pop. And so, damn businessmen, that's why we need the Fed. And even if they haven't done a real good job, it's just been their practice century. But now, 100 years out, now they're good at it, and now they can restrain that boom and bust and smooth that boom and bust out. They have to.
Well, a couple things. It's true that they've gotten better than they were. I mean, they're intelligent men and women, and they're going to learn. But as something else I cite in my piece, Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, who's a very good money and banking economist at San Jose State, points out that while they've gotten better at controlling inflation, I mean, that hyperinflation that people have predicted, for many, many years, for some reason has not arrived. So they have gotten better at controlling inflation and keeping it kind of small and low. But what they've done now since 2008 under Bernanke is become a central planner of capital allocation. And Hummel, I have the link, Hummel documents this in an article that was in the Independent Review to show that the Fed, for the first time, never done this before 2008, is directing capital to particular companies. You know, in the old days, the Fed would, increase credit, and then the banks would just sort of lend it out, and the Fed wasn't trying to direct it here or there. Now, they're in a whole new mode where they are directing it to particular industries and companies even. And so we now have a central planner for the allocation of credit and capital. And that obviously has no place in a free society. So it's another reason to get rid of the Fed.
Well, I can tell that the people on TV are getting a little smarter about this too, because they talk about, well, geez, they're not ever going to quit creating new money and buying up all this bad debt, are they? Because what would happen to the markets if that happened? I mean, that's the way they talk on CNBC and what have you.
Well, right.
They can't tighten it now.
The Fed does manipulate the whole market process. It's been buying mortgage-backed securities from banks, and so relieving the banks of what might be very dubious, quote, assets. At the same time, we're not seeing that money generate a price inflation because the Fed – and what the Fed has been doing mostly is borrowing the money back immediately by paying interest on the bank's Fed account. So they're leaving the money, in their Fed account and drawing interest. It's also a secure way for the banks to, they're only getting 0.25%, but it's a secure loan to the government. And so it's safe and it's attractive. And the demand for, the loanable funds is not booming because people are uncertain about different things, Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, et cetera. And so there's not a great demand for loans either. So, that's why we're not seeing inflation, despite the fact that the federal government, the Fed, has been creating money. But they found a way to keep the money bottled up. So I don't think that's the great danger right now. The great danger is that Bernanke is allocating capital. So, see, what people don't understand is, I mean, it shouldn't take much to see that the Fed is not a good source of security. In a market, in a truly free marketplace, there's a high degree of decentralization, which means anybody who makes a mistake is making a fairly local mistake. And so a lot of people, even if a few people around, the center where the mistake occurs, get hurt, it's still going to be fairly contained. But when you take an economy like the United States, what is it, $15 trillion, and you have a Fed, a centralized Fed, if it makes a mistake, everybody suffers. Well, except for the few privileged people that are going to rake in profits. But the whole society and maybe the whole world will suffer. So you don't want centralization. You want decentralization. But the Fed it makes things as centralized as they could get.
Yeah. Well, and you still have inflation in certain sectors, like in housing and in the stock market. It's always the stock market that benefits, while, you know, the average person actually is sort of, if they have any money at all, they're sort of forced to invest in speculative things like that, when really they're not that kind of expert. They ought to just have a local savings account, but it might as well be a crime to have a savings account, because inflation will kick your ass on that interest rate.
Well, Chris, like when you say inflation in certain sectors, I mean, you got to be careful, because inflation usually means, I mean, typically
widespread price inflation. Yeah.
A general increase, sustained increase in prices. So to say, you know, gold's going up, that's not inflation. Or to say the stock market's booming, that doesn't count as inflation. There can be a lot of explanations for that. It's true. Interest rates are low. And that's a reason why people will turn to the stock market, because they want to try to get a better return. But of course, you're right, it's riskier. You need to know more, and not everybody has the ability to spend the time to become a knowledgeable investor. And it's never going to be the case that anybody can walk into the stock market with and do as well as anybody else. Because if somebody who puts the time in and studies and approaches it as a real vocation, you might expect that person to do a little better than someone who just wanders in and says, "Hey, I'll buy some stocks." That's a shame. And like I said, I also point out in the article that we have this myth that the Fed controls interest rates, and that again that flies in the face of good economics, because the Fed can target its own overnight bank rate, the federal funds rate, but even there it doesn't always hit its own targets. But the idea that it controls or sets or even heavily influences mortgage rates and other kinds of interest rates is a myth. And this is good. This is only good economics. Because look, if the Fed is doing something to lower rates, people respond to that. People aren't robots, right? They see what's going on. If they get a sense that the Fed is creating money in order to lower interest rates and the money is flowing out into the economy, lenders are going to raise rates, aren't they? They're going to want an inflation premium. They don't want to get screwed by the fact that price inflation is going on, and they don't want to get paid back in cheaper dollars. So rates might go down in the very short run, but then they're going to go up soon when people see what they're doing. And these days, people are much more sophisticated. I mean, the markets are much more sophisticated at watching what the Fed does. It's easier than ever to switch from one currency to another, because currency controls over the years have fallen away under various kinds of deregulation. And so people are able to adjust their behavior much quicker than they could previously. So the idea that the Fed can inflate and then hold down rates is really the opposite of the truth, and it assumes that people are sort of automatons just walking around oblivious to the surroundings.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the same time, then, the sectors where the Fed is directly injecting capital here and there, people can wise ride up to that and just short housing stocks or short whatever it is that's being propped up, right?
Well, there's more information available than ever before, and it travels, basically at the speed of light. So you're right. Sophisticated people who are keeping an eye on things can switch from sector A to sector B in response to a change in Fed policy. I've heard the Fed compared to a kid sitting in a little car seat that has a phony steering wheel on it, and the kid believes he's steering the car, and the parents encourage him to believe he's steering the car, but he ain't steering the car. So there's this illusion that the Fed steers the economy, and that's just not true. I mean, it could wreck it if it did certain things, but it doesn't steer it.
Yeah. Well, although who knows what steer means exactly in that case. I mean,
well,
I know a guy, for example, who he was a student of Murray Rothbard. He had read America's Great Depression, I guess, and he's a construction guy. But he would just watch the federal funds rate, and as soon as he saw Bernanke was beginning to raise the rate to try to prick the bubble and let the air out in 2007, I think it would have been in 07 when he started, he knew, a la Rothbard, that you can't let the air out slowly. Eventually it's going to pop. And so at that point, he sold his construction company and waited till the whole market collapsed and whatever, and then went to get back in the business later, I guess. But
yeah, keep in mind, even the Fed doesn't set. And I emphasize that word, the federal funds rate. It targets it by buying or selling securities, right, to the banks or the securities dealers.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it was a deliberate policy of beginning to deflate or to slow the rate of inflation or something at that point, right?
Well, it, like I said, it targets it, but it often doesn't hit its target. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how reliable. I guess, you know, I guess if you were this guy, you want to err on the side of caution, and so I suppose you did the right thing. But I don't know generally how good a guide that is, and you know, I don't give investment advice. I'm the last person in the world anybody should listen to about you know, what moves to make in response to the Fed.
I didn't necessarily mean that. I guess, well, I'm still kind of stuck on the difference between just, or maybe why there's a difference between just having inflation across the economy, price inflation across the economy, versus having the kinds of distortions. I mean, because after all, in the Bush era, price inflation on the shelf, I mean, fuel and food prices were up some and that kind of thing. Obviously housing, but mostly housing, right? That kind of thing. It wasn't widespread price inflation. It was huge distortions and bubbles in
certain
markets.
Right, but we don't have that inflation. Sure, the government can adopt a whole series of, and which it did, a whole series of policies to stimulate demand for housing. You know, mortgage deduction and the Community Reinvestment Act, and then Fannie and Freddie jumping in, and so they're gonna have all kinds of policies that make it attractive to buy housing rather than something else, and then you'll see a rise in demand and rise in prices. But that's not what we mean by inflation.
Right.
General. We mean by a general rise in prices.
Well, we ought to do this more often because we got to go. We're all out of time. Thanks, Sheldon.
Okay. Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Everybody, that's Sheldon Richmond from FFF.org. See you tomorrow.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, You know, they publish great articles at FFF.org every day, but their best stuff goes in the Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at FFF.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you.